Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, December 26th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, New Earth System Model takes Karuk Tribe perspective into consideration, and Ray Hamill with the sports report. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
Earlier this month, a research paper was published looking at how Earth system models can assess climate change effects on Earth systems and help climate adaptation plans. The goal was to include the perspective of groups that live in the impact area of the Earth system models, the belief being that without these perspectives, the usefulness of the model would be limited. The research was conducted over two studies in different locations, the Arctic Rivers Project in Alaska and the Mid-Klamath Project in Northern California. Looking at the Mid-Klamath Project, researchers worked with the Karuk tribe, adapting the Earth system models to better understand and their knowledge and perspective on climate change and prescribed burning. KMUD News talked with Yifan Chen, a researcher and computational hydrologist who worked on the Mid-Klamath Project. He explained the origins of this project.
This project was not initiated by us. It was initiated by Cleo, who was an assistant professor at University of Washington, but now he is fire manager at the Klamath Department of Natural Resources. And he started this project because he think it would be helpful to actually using, leveraging Earth system models to do some climate adaptation. And later on, the Klamath culture practitioner, Leaf, actually come up with this idea of like actually thinking, incorporating the prescribed and culture burning, as well as the potential mitigations to the salmons in the Klamath River Basin.
He talked about the experience working with the Karuk community.
So as a researcher, it's a really rare opportunity for me to directly work with the indigenous community. And I very much acknowledge and appreciate the opportunity that actually Cleo proposed this project and I get the chance to participate in it. And I feel very welcome in the project. So I actually visited the Karuk community last June. We had like an in-person workshop over there, and it's been a great experience for me.
Chen explained the Earth system models and how it integrated feedbacks from the Karuk tribe.
For the Mid-Klamath project, we used the land component. Like we specifically for the land, which is the Community Terrestrial System Model, CTSM. That's a state of the science land surface model. For example, there's like two outstanding examples of how we incorporated the like feedback from the community. The first is like when we are using the default like model configurations. There's a lot large biases in the stream flow, which does not align with observations. And the community says like, we will not like trust this model output because it's just like deviates from the observation too much. So that's why it motivates us to do this modeling techniques called parameter calibration, to actually improve the model performance to better align with the stream flow observation. And the second example is the fire scenario, because even though CTSM, the model, does have a fire modules in the model, but the fire module is a simple, like they only calculate the average burned areas using socioeconomic metrics. So it cannot capture the dynamic fire spread. So that's why we co-developed this snapshot method where we just measure the maximum possible fire burning practice they can do for the entire region. Excuse me. And we use that input in the model. So pretty much it says like this is probably the largest ecological impact or hydrological impact to this region.
Going over the process, Chen admitted there was limitations to the Earth system models that was unable to incorporate the needs of the tribe, admitting Earth system models still have a way to go before it can be used to look at real-world processes.
When I actually went to the community and listened to a lot of the stories, I feel like there is a lot of, because the Earth system model is kind of abstraction and simplification of the real world processes. So I also noticed that there are many processes that cannot be like realistically represented in the Earth system models, but that are important to the communities. I think there are still like long ways to go for the Earth system modeling communities to better to maybe develop better models or like come up with smarter ways to actually like coming up with like useful and usable data products for the communities. I think that's probably the take home message that I would that I can think of when I after I visit the community, because like they as I mentioned the story about the compound interest of the preventive fires, which are super interesting, but it's kind of hard to be captured in the existing model frame.
Chen was very grateful for the experience and thanked the tribe.
Yeah, I generally just like very appreciate this collaboration opportunity, and I'm very appreciate that the community is welcoming researchers like me to have this collaboration, which is really quite eye-opening for me. And I'm very grateful and hope to have more opportunities for collaboration in the future.
To find this research article, look up the article Toward Co-Designed Earth System Models, Reflecting End-User Priorities and Local Applications from a Modeler's Perspective. Ray Hamill brings us details of all this week's big local sports stories, including the latest high school and college basketball news and where two HDNL athletes are taking their talents after graduation in 2026.
The local high school basketball season is building momentum as a busy December of tournament action begins to wind down, with league play now just a couple of weeks away. Hello and welcome to this week's KMUD News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have updates on all of the latest high school basketball action in just a moment as we take a look at all of the big local sports stories of the week, including all the latest college basketball news and news of where two HDNL senior student athletes are taking their talents after graduation in 2026. But first up, it was another busy week of local high school basketball, and a good one for three HDNL boys teams in particular. St. Bernard's, South Fork, and Del Norte all won their respective tournaments over the weekend. The South Fork boys hosted their annual Gene Cotter Memorial Tournament and took the championship with a 59-48 win over Willits in Saturday's championship game. The Cubs won all three of their tournament games and were led by senior Sean Smith, who has begun the new season in style. Schmidt had a career night in a 74-66 win over Upper Lake in his team's opening tournament game, finishing with 37 points and 15 rebounds, and he was named tournament MVP for his excellent play at both ends of the floor. Fellow senior Travis Way was also named to the all-tournament team for the Cubs for his stellar defensive play all weekend. The Cubs, who also defeated Laytonville in non-tournament action last week, have now won four straight games and are 8-7. It's been a nice turnaround for the team after some early struggles that saw them drop their opening four games of the season. The St. Bernard's boys also continued to impress last weekend, winning all three of their games on the way to clinching the Kelseyville tournament, including a 59-36 win over the host school in the championship game on Saturday. The Crusaders, who are now ranked number 11 in the North Coast section, have won six straight games and back-to-back tournament championships, having also placed first at the Mount Shasta tournament the previous weekend. Liam Dyer and Garrett Shannon Shanahan both had big games in Saturday's final. Dyer had a double-double, finishing with 25 points and 13 rebounds, while Shanahan added 16 rebounds and 8 points. The Crusaders are now 8-1. The Del Norte boys, meanwhile, made it 3 weekend tournament championships for the HDNL boys by winning all 3 of their games at the Anderson tournament and taking that tournament championship for the 3rd straight year. The Warriors have been one of the hottest Big 5 teams through the early season and have won 6 straight games to go to 10-2, including a 50-41 win over Reading Christian in Saturday's tournament final. Also in action last week, the Arcata boys went 1-2 at the Red Bluff tournament, closing out with a 65-53 win over Eagle Point in their final game. The Tigers are now 6-7 on the season. The Fortuna boys were at the Motherlode Madness tournament at Argonaut High and went 1-2 in their 3 tournament games, including losses to Union Mine and Liberty Ranch, with a victory over Weed sandwiched in between. The Huskies are now 4-10. And rounding out a busy weekend for the HDNL boys, the McKinneyville Panthers went 2-1 at the Frank Wells Classic at Albany High School, with victories over Skyline and San Lorenzo and a loss to Terra Linda. That loss was just the 3rd of the season for the Panthers, who are now 9-3. Several local girls teams were also in action last weekend, including a strong showing by the St. Bernard's Crusaders, who won the Kelseyville tournament. After losing tournament finals in each of the previous 2 weekends, it was a case of third time's the charm for the SB girls, who defeated the host school 67-35 in their final and improved to 7-3. Sophomore point guard Carly Baum was named tournament MVP for the champs, who defeated Little Four rival Ferndale 63-40 in Friday night's semi-final. The Wildcats would bounce back to finish 3rd, beating Middletown 59-53 the following day. The Ferndale girls, who are battling some early season injuries, are now 8-2. The McKinneyville girls were also in action at that tournament and went 2-1, bouncing back from an opening loss to Ferndale with back-to-back wins over Casa Grande and Clear Lake. The Panthers are now 8-4. The Arcata girls were in action at the Round Robin Justin Siena tournament and won 2 of 3 games, defeating both Pinole Valley and James Logan before closing out with a 64-53 loss to the host school. Arcata, Pinole Valley and Justin Siena each finished 2-1 in tournament play. The South Fork girls were in action at their own Gene Cotter Memorial tournament, falling to Laytonville, Point Arena and Willits and dropping to 1-12. The Hoopa girls also travelled to Miranda for the Gene Cotter tournament and won 2 of their 3 games, defeating Willits and Point Arena with a loss to Upper Lake sandwiched in between. The Warriors closed out tournament play with a 79-24 win over Point Arena, scoring a season high in points and improving to 5-9. And rounding out a busy week for the HDNL girls, Fortuna played at the Red Bluff tournament and won 2 of 3 games, opening with a loss to Enterprise before beating Corning and West Valley and improving to 8-3, while the Eureka girls played 3 non-tournament road games, beating Annalee before losing to both Maria Carrillo and American Canyon and dropping to 8-4. Some of the HDNL schools will take a break from tournament play over Christmas, although several will be back in action at various tournaments over the weekend. League play begins early in the new year. In local college basketball, meanwhile, all 4 Humboldt County teams were in action this past week. The Cal Poly Humboldt women won a pair of road conference games at Cal State San Marcos and Cal State Monterey Bay to go to 4-0 in conference and 6-4 overall, while the Cal Poly Humboldt men split, losing to San Marcos and beating Monterey to go to 2-2 in conference and 4-6 overall. The College of the Redwoods men were in action at the Kris Kringle tournament in Santa Rosa and won their semi-final against Cuesta 81-64 before losing to Santa Rosa in the final 101-81 and dropping to 10-7. The CO women played a non-tournament game at Cosumnes River on Friday and lost 74-44 to drop to 6-7. And rounding out a busy week for local sports, a pair of HDNL seniors announced last week where they will be continuing their athletic careers after graduation in 2026 while signing their letters of intent in front of teammates and family. McKinneyville's Grace Pimentel is staying local and will play women's soccer at College of the Redwoods, while St. Bernard's Alyssa Boham will compete in track and field at Oregon Tech. And that's this week's KMUD News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
Turning to Mendocino, 3 days before Christmas, a family outing to McCarricker State Park turned into a desperate rescue attempt, one carried out not by first responders, but by the young people who happened to be there. Elise Cox reports for KMUD and MendoLocal.news.
Marion Black and her two daughters were just leaving the beach when they heard someone scream for help. They'd been coming to this beach for years, driving over from Ukiah to visit the tide pools near Laguna Point. It was a holiday tradition. They loved the ocean here, and they also knew when it couldn't be trusted.
We noticed that the tide was in, but the riptide was really bad.
Natasha Black is 21. She says you can see the danger in the sand itself.
You could just tell by the way the sand goes all the way down. So it's like when the waves pull out, it almost looks like it's going downhill. Like you would get sucked under, or it's just, it pulls out really quick. And also when there's waves crossing like square waves almost, it looked like just very bad, like riptide wise. You didn't see anybody surfing out there. Sometimes you'll see people in wetsuits surfing out there. I saw no one out there that day.
The three women had been walking the beach near the parking lot for about half an hour. They were headed toward the boardwalk, to the tide pools, when Gianna, Natasha's younger sister, turned to say something. That's when she saw the tragedy unfold.
So I saw the whole thing. We were walking towards our car. We had just come off of the dunes. We were walking up. We were going to, like, brush off our feet, change our shoes.
An older woman was standing on the beach near some rocks. A wave knocked her down. And before anyone could react, she was pulled into deeper water.
Before I could even blink, the tide had pulled her out and she was screaming.
Gianna yelled to her mom and sister. Everyone moved at once.
My mom started yelling, call 911, but there was another lady there who wasn't reacting, so I told my mom to call 911. Well, I went down, but by the time I got down, she was already too far away for me to go swim out and grab her safely.
Between the women and the victim was a river channel, fast and deep. Gianna ran back toward the parking lot, flagging down cars, asking if anyone had something that floated. No one did. Natasha stayed closer to the water, shouting to the woman that help was coming.
I know how to swim, but not very well, and same with my sister.
That's when they got the attention of a group of young men who, like Natasha and her sister, appeared to be in their early 20s.
The one guy that we met, I didn't get his name, but he ran down there, jumped.
The risk was enormous, not just the riptide, but the cold, cold water.
You put your foot in there and, you know, it goes numb right away. It was absolutely freezing cold water.
As the swimmer fought his way out, people on shore scrambled. Someone handed Natasha a blanket.
I put that on my shoulder and we crossed the river about probably up to almost up to like our stomach. So it was pretty deep at that point. We were just trying to cross it. And everyone ran after the guy that jumped in. That way we were just prepared by the time he got her out to have the blanket ready for her.
The swimmer swam quickly, efficiently, like a pro. He reached the woman and towed her back. On the beach, his friends helped him pull her from the water. Natasha and Gianna were right behind them.
It took three of them to pull her out of the water, and then me and my sister made it there. And we wrapped her, and we tried to turn her on her side to make sure all the water was leaving her body.
The woman drifted in and out of consciousness. She vomited seawater. She shivered violently.
We sat her up because, like I said, she was nodding in and out. We thought maybe if we sat her up straight, she would kind of gain some consciousness back, but that wasn't working.
Yeah.
So we just tried to warm her up, sit with her. We kept checking her pulse. I was checking her pulse on her right arm and behind her ears. Everybody, you know, we took turns holding her up. It was like me and one of the guys, and we kind of switched off. And like I said, we just started noticing her pulse became slower and slower. We were just trying to get her name, calm her down, but she was in shock, and I believe she was, you know, got hypothermia because she was shivering. She was so cold.
Natasha estimates the woman had been in the water for about 10 minutes. Another 10 minutes passed before firefighters and rescue crews arrived. The young swimmer and his friends never gave their names. The Mendocino Voice has identified the woman as a 77-year-old Fort Bragg resident. That information has not yet been independently confirmed. What is certain is this. On a dangerous day, young strangers ran toward the water, knowing the risks, and did everything they could to save a life. For KMUD News and MendoLocal.News, I'm Elise Cox.
In state news, California working groups fight for more oversight of AI. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
64 groups representing causes related to civil rights, consumer advocacy, and tech accountability are banding together to fight deregulation of the artificial intelligence industry. The California AI Working Group has signed a letter to members of Congress opposing a bill that would allow financial firms to deploy artificial intelligence without regulatory oversight or enforcement by requesting a waiver in the interest of innovation. Tina Rosales-Torres with the Western Center on Law and Poverty says Senator Ted Cruz is pushing a similar measure called the Sandbox Act that would apply to all sectors, not just finance.
If the federal government gets their way with these preemption laws, then the state of California cannot stop AI companies from using individuals' data however they want, or even stop AI companies from, you know, raising the cost of living from bread to housing.
President Trump recently issued an executive order declaring that federal AI policy would preempt state laws. Opponents say AI must be regulated to protect people's privacy and make sure AI-powered systems don't contribute to racial inequities in access to housing or credit. Rosales-Torres says there are many examples of companies using AI to manipulate prices.
There was cases of Uber charging different prices for different people based on where they were, the time of day, whether their phone battery was full or lower. So we're trying to stop that, but with the federal laws, we wouldn't be able to.
In 2022, the Department of Justice sued Facebook, alleging the company was targeting ads for housing based on what online history revealed about a user's race or current neighborhood. This week, Instacart said it would stop using an AI-powered tool that allowed the grocery app to charge different prices for the same item, following an investigation by Consumer Reports. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, UN Security Council holds urgent meeting on U.S.-Venezuela tensions. UN says dialogue is only path to peace. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
The urgent meeting of the UN Security Council came at the request of Venezuela. It opened with a briefing on the situation by Assistant UN Secretary General Mohamed Khaled Kiari.
President Donald Trump has stated that he is going to use the full power of the United States to take on and eradicate these drug cartels, no matter where they are operating from. The Venezuelan government, including its permanent representative, has described the measures by the United States as a serious threat to international peace and security. Most recently, in a letter dated 16 December and addressed to the President of the Security Council, the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Venezuela asserted that the United States is violating the principle prohibiting the threat or use of force in international relations.
U.S. Ambassador Mike Waltz defended the administration's escalation, saying transnational terrorists are the single most serious threat to this hemisphere and to the United States.
Let me begin by stating and reiterating the United States does not recognize Nicolas Maduro or his cronies as the legitimate government of Venezuela. Nicolas Maduro is a fugitive from American justice and the head of the foreign terrorist organization Cartel de los Soles.
He showed no sign of backing down from a campaign that has killed at least 105 people in boat strikes since early September, as well as the seizure of oil tankers. The Russian Federation blasted the Trump administration's actions as cowboy-like conduct. Venezuela's ambassador quoted Simon Bolivar, saying the United States seems to be destined by Providence to plague Latin America with misery in the name of liberty. He said the threat is not Venezuela, it is the current U.S. government. He added his opinion on the Trump administration's motivation, saying it's not drugs, it's not security, it's not freedom, it is oil, it's the mines, it's the land. Denmark's representative urged de-escalation and restraint, saying the Caribbean should be preserved as a zone of peace. As for the United Nations, Assistant Secretary General Kiari says the head of the UN is ready to support all diplomatic efforts.
He welcomes initiatives by member states, offers for mediation, and proposals for peaceful solutions. Dialogue is the only viable path toward lasting peace and preventing further instability and human suffering.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Alaska chapter of Safari Club International took a group of men from Kipnuk deer hunting last month. The hunters were evacuees from a storm that ravaged the western Alaska coast. After more than a month of staying in shelters and hotel rooms in Anchorage, they were quick to accept the invitation. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, what transpired turned out to be more than just a hunt.
The Safari Club and Alaska Native subsistence hunters have often been on the opposite side in debates over fish and game management. And some who have followed the politics over the years find it puzzling that the Safari Club reached out to help Kipnuk hunters displaced by the storm. But John Sturgeon, a longtime Safari Club member, says it's not a surprise to him.
I'm not even sure it's a hunting thing. It's just a human thing. We're hunters. They're hunters.
Sturgeon helped to organize the hunt.
We have the resources to help, and them eating wild game and going out after wild game is really important to them. And we just said, well, this is something that we can do to help, especially at Christmas time.
What started out with five hunters snowballed. The evacuees had no clothes or gear, which they either lost in the storm or had to leave behind. Club members loaned them guns and scopes. One dug into his own pocket to outfit them for the hunt. The Safari Club bought them hunting licenses, chartered a boat from Whittier to Montague Island, where the men took nine Sitka black-tailed deer.
We were hunting deer in a beach, which I never ever thought I would be hunting.
It's the first time Daryl John had gone hunting since ocean waves carried his house away.
When I was gutting deer, I knew my family was going to eat something. Made me feel like I was providing for my family again.
Although Daryl never dreamed he'd go hunting in such a faraway place like Prince William Sound, he suddenly felt more like his old self. When the hunters returned, they wanted to share their catch with others displaced by the storm. Suddenly, plans mushroomed into a feast to feed more than 200. The Safari Club collected donations of fish and wild game, which included a seal from Kodiak Island.
Seals have a strong scent.
Daryl John's wife, Lacey, knew right away what was cooking.
It smelled like home. I just breathed in.
In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
A Christmas parade on the Navajo Nation was suddenly cut short this week after a suspected drunk driver struck and killed one bystander and injured three more. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has details.
The Kayenta Township near Monument Valley shared cheer on social media ahead of its annual Christmas market and parade at the rodeo grounds.
The parade is going to start on Navajo Route 591, which is right behind Chevron. Okay, it's like you're going to the flea market here if you live in Kayenta. That one's going to start right at 5 o'clock, so be ready.
But about 10 minutes later, that holiday tradition came to an abrupt halt after an alleged drunk driver entered the parade route and hit four people, including a juvenile and pregnant woman. The Navajo Police Department confirmed a child had died and a suspect is in custody. The sale of alcohol as well as possession and consumption is prohibited on tribal land. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
This year, the Chickasaw Nation in Oklahoma and Feed the Children partnered to bring holiday packages to an estimated 800 Ada area families. The recent drive-through distribution included a 25-pound box of food and a 15-pound box of personal care items, books, toys, and other products. This is the 10th year the tribe and organization have partnered to help families during the holidays. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporters, Ray Hamill, Elise Cox, Susan Potter, Christopher Martinez, and Antonio Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send in an email to to news@kema.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.